Actually, Ollie, I'm going to Amazon Now you some wieners. 12 jars of
that
wieners.
That sounds really odd when you say it like that.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Cyber Sounds. This episode, we're going to be looking at the global nature of cyber attacks. And we are delighted to welcome Leticia Fouquet, who is the global head of cyber at Charles Taylor Adjusting. Leticia, fantastic to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good. Well, I think what would be great to start off with is perhaps if you could just explain a little bit about Charles Taylor and what you guys do.
Yeah, so Charles Taylor was established quite a long time ago, 1884. We now have about 1,200 adjusters around the globe and about 120 locations in 30 countries. And we provide services to, obviously, the insurance market. And our cyber team is actually recruited within the pool of adjusters that we have in our company.
And I know that for you guys, cyber is a huge thing and a growing market, and it's something that you are dealing with on a global basis now.
Yes, indeed. So we started with a very small kind of team in 2014. Although we started looking into cyber in 2012, but that really started fully in 2014. And then we've grown the team since to about 58, I think, is the latest count of incident managers now.
So how did you then make your way into cyber?
So the person that was heading the cyber team initially, she was on her own. So it wasn't really much of a team. So she was the team started with one person handling quite a lot of claims in the UK, in the USA and Canada. And then Australia came in, and Australia being on the other side of the world, it was a little bit difficult to do everything at once. So we then looked into getting more people involved. And I volunteered initially to help with that. So I got involved in very small claims that had already been started by someone else. I was just picking up after the initial kind of emergency madness kind of phase, and just adjusting at that point. And then we looked to recruit a bit more people. And then Andrew Shepherd took over. And I'd already handled a few claims. So I said, well, can I just keep, you know, being on the team, and can I be given a bit more responsibilities? So it started like that.
I mean, I think one of the really interesting aspects of what we do is seeing how what is essentially seen as a relatively small business. So you could have an e-commerce website that has been set up and has grown very, very quickly in a short space of time, and is suddenly a global business. And they've only got one office in the UK, but they're suddenly providing services or providing products to customers all over the world. And that's an issue when you have some kind of cyber incident, because you suddenly are exposed to all those different laws and regulations. And a lot of companies that we deal with and our clients, I don't think, to some extent, don't really appreciate that when they're setting up. And it's only when they have an incident that they realize, oh, wow, you know, we've got to react to this, and we've got to do it on a global scale.
And the funny thing is, often they don't necessarily know the makeup of their own client base. So we've had several matters where we're told at the outset our clients are based in this jurisdiction. And when you actually start to look at the data that they produce, it turns out that they're selling or providing services right the way across the world. And somehow they don't know that.
Yeah.
We've definitely seen this as well. We had a case a few years ago with that. exactly the same as what you're describing here. Their first advice was that they were only trading in the UK. And then they said, oh, sorry, UK plus Ireland, Republic of Ireland. And actually, they had about 40,000 customers in the Republic of Ireland. So it's not a small, it wasn't a small thing for them. And then we discovered that not only did they, were they doing that, but on their website, they were advertising prices in Australian dollars, in, you know, in euros, in whatever currency you could think about. Plus, actually, delivery charges or fees, you know, for these countries, well, for various countries as well. So when we questioned them and said, well, if you're offering that, obviously you're selling there. Yeah. Oh, no, we're not selling there. But yeah, they were.
It's actually, it's amazing, isn't it? And the first thing that we'll do when we get instructed is try and figure out what the group of customers that is affected is, and then get a spreadsheet of all those customers against the countries and or states that they reside in. And then we need to very, very quickly coordinate our global team to be able to advise in relation to any regulatory notifications that you have to make in any of those jurisdictions.
Yeah, because you could have just one person in one jurisdiction, but you've got an obligation to notify them, actually. Whereas you could have 200 in another jurisdiction, or even more than that, thousands. But actually, the obligation is much less strict. Or there's ways of separating some of these people in different type of data sub kind of subjects. So it's trying to keep on top of everything. That is very difficult with these cross-border claims. And also, how do you notify not only the regulators, but also the data subjects? Because it's not just sending a letter. In some, we've seen that in some states, you actually have to have a letter posted. So it's not even going to be an email. You need to have the postal address and have a letter posted.
Yeah.
So it makes it very complex, even when you just deal with one country as the United States, because each state will have different regulations as well.
Ollie?
Yeah.
I fancy testing you on something.
Okay. Sounds ominous. I love it when Tom does this.
we talk all the time about the sort of frequency of change in cyber. And it feels like everything's moving at a million miles an hour. And as a result, we sort of get into a mindset that 2 years ago, this wasn't happening. Or 5 years ago, this didn't exist. And sometimes you need to sort of take a sanity check on things and just remember the bigger picture. And so I was looking earlier, and I'm sure you've all read this because it's fascinating stuff, but on the ICO website, there's a page on their history. And I might have been the first person to ever visit this page.
you'll go in the history somewhere. Now.
Yeah. So, obviously, you can't buy me a pint, and I can't buy you a pint at the moment. However, when we're able to sort of sit in a bar together again, we can sort of repay each other. Ollie, if you get this right, I'll buy you a pint.
Okay.
If you get it wrong, you buy me 2 pints.
Hang on a minute, that's not bad.
I once bet a friend £1 million on a pool game. Because he'd potted everything bar the black, and I hadn't potted anything, and so the deal was, if he pots the black, I buy him a pint because he'd come out without his money, and if I win, then I get £1 million. And he potted the black, but he also potted the white, so I won. So he still owes me.
He's paying you in installments.
Okay, so your dignity is at stake here, Ollie. Okay, this is a question about when the ICO was established. And I'm watching your fingers, by the way, just to check you're not typing away. So what came first? The ICO or the Band-Aid single, which was in December 1984.
Could you sing us a little snippet of that poem so that we can get in the kind of right era?
No, well, later, when everyone logs off, I'll do a bit of singing. So what came first? The ICO, so the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK, or the Band-Aid single from December 1984. And if you get this wrong, frankly, you're an idiot.
Okay, so I was initially thinking that the ICO was probably established in the early 90s for some reason. I don't know why. It's just a feeling that I've got. So I'll stick with that feeling and I'll say that the Live Aid single came first.
Was it the Band-Aid single?
Band-Aid.
Live Aid was a year later. Liz, okay. This is all stuff before you were born, by the way.
Yeah, I think you've been sneaky though. So I think it's probably the opposite of what would seem sensible.
But maybe I'm double bluffing you.
Or triple bluffing. Maybe I've gone. I think it's a triple bluff.
I would have put it before, if I'm honest.
So Letitia, Liz say before. Ollie, you said after.
Mm.
Ollie. You're an idiot.
Oh, no.
So the ICO was established early 1984.
I was about to say, I think it was even before the 1990s. A little bit before.
84. Yeah.
Yeah, we're not born at all.
So I owe you 2 pints, but you didn't say 2 pints of what, so... I presume that's my choosing.
Liquid gold. Yeah.
2 pints of absinthe and you have to drink them both.
One thing Kennedy's and CTA share is the global coverage, and we find with the breaches that we deal with, it's absolutely invaluable. How have you seen the development of global breaches over the time that you've been at CTA?
So we've really followed the demand of our clients initially, trying to see, you know, where things were developing and where the, you know, where the clients of these insurers were based effectively. So we followed that trend initially. And more recently, we've tried to adapt and develop our teams where we see things changing, where we see there's more of an interest in data protection. So the Middle East has been one, and Latin America has been another one, because, you know, other markets were a bit more mature. But there was a demand for going into LATAM. And in the Middle East, I think there's a demand in the Middle East for more regulations in any case. So there's bound to be some claims coming out of that for clients that have not followed the rules effectively.
Where do you see the market really changing? Because you've got visibility on so many different jurisdictions.
But there was a big buzz with some European countries five, six years ago. There was a high demand for Italy, for example. And it was a country with quite different demands as well. You know, calls had to be answered in Italian. Everything had to be in Italian. There was no negotiation around that at all. We didn't see the claims coming out of that at all. So we set up, and we still set up to answer any incident that would be in Italy. We then, you know, rather than look just at the countries per country kind of support. We then looked more into, you know, could we actually provide support from where we already established and bridge the gap where we probably do not have a permanent office somewhere. So we're also supporting now countries where we do not have an office, but we have the language skills. So Turkey, for example. So we handle that from the UK. And other countries, we also have a Norwegian and Swedish and Danish-speaking colleague as well. So we haven't got the foothold there. But we've got the panel who is either established kind of network or local firms. So we manage this way. But I think, you know, the next stage will be maybe not just countries, but more new business type or new lines like marine, cyber, for example. It's actually something that is developing quite more speedily at the end of this year than it was, they say, last year or the year before.
Yeah, well, funny enough, I gave a presentation on marine cyber this morning. And it's a fascinating topic because the breaches operate in a totally different way. And they, you know, inevitably they're more complicated, they're more expensive to deal with because you look at, say, a breach on board a vessel at sea. It becomes a really serious situation in that you've immediately got lives at risk, which really ups the ante. So you've got the crew that you need to take care of. You've got potentially passengers. But then in terms of how you run the incident response and the forensics piece, it becomes really difficult because you naturally think, well, we'll get a forensics team on board, but if the vessel is 200 miles offshore, that becomes really difficult. So you're then stuck with a remote link to the vessel, and that's obviously via satellite internet. But that's effectively the same speed as dial-up internet from the 90s. And so how do you get the forensics team to install endpoint detection? How do you get them to take an image of the system? How do you get them to sort of combat the attacker in a live environment over dial-up speed internet? It becomes really, really difficult. And so it's an area that we're looking at really actively at the moment. We're on a couple of panels. It seems that in the marine world, people were ignoring this up until about 5 or 6 years ago. And then some major breaches and incidents starts landing. And the owners of the vessels just can't ignore it anymore. Because there's also talk about the classic pirates now starting to turn their hand to electronic piracy and using the malware that they can effectively buy as a sort of malware for a service, and use that as part of the attack. And so it's a rapidly developing field, but it's got its whole kind of own ecosystem associated with it.
Yeah, it's also a mix of old and new kind of systems. It's a mix of the problem with the staff, you know, not being trained properly as well and bringing their own devices. There's quite a lot of things that, you know, if it wasn't on a ship, we would say to the insured, why, kind of. But, you know, these are practices that they allow on the ship. So there's a real education as well there. Also, you deal with people that are effectively... the crew could be a crew of people coming from like 50 countries on one ship. Mm-hmm. So they also deal with another layer of issues, because if the data that's been accessed is actually staff data, and that's got nothing to do with the boat itself, but actually it's data about, you know, the shipping operations and staff and personnel and crew on those ships, then you're dealing with a lot of country of residence issues as well. For the staff.
Okay. Shall we play a game?
Yes, please. Yeah,
Letitia, are you ready to play a game?
Yeah, yes, I am, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So this game is called Fines and Finest. And in a minute, Liz is going to describe two things for you. She's going to describe, first of all, a recent GDPR fine from a regulator in the EU. And also she's going to describe a luxury item. And both these things are around about the same amount. So it's going to be multiple choice, and Liz is going to give you three options, and you've got to guess which option is correct in terms of the cost of these two items. Over to you, Liz.
Okay. So the first one is the Swedish regulator, which fined Google in March 2020 for insufficient fulfillment of data subject rights. And the luxury item is a 1962 Ferrari, which is the most expensive car that's ever been sold at auction. So the three options are going to be A, 3 million euros, B, 5 million euros, or C, 7 million euros.
Doesn't speak to me, any of this. Not the Google thing. I remember reading about this, but not the car is just not giving me anything at all. So that's going to be a pure guess. well, I had in mind closer to 3. So let's just say 3 million.
3 million. It's actually 7 million euros.
Wow.
Imagine buying a car for 7 million euros.
Tom, your car is nearly 7 million euros, isn't it?
Not at the moment. He's driving a Volvo.
No, I'm not yet. I'm fuming. Oh, man. Absolutely fuming.
Okay, should we do another one?
Yeah.
So this is in March 2020, the Spanish regulator fined Vodafone for insufficient technical and organizational measures to ensure information security. And the luxury item is a crocodile skin umbrella. How much do you think that would cost? Do you think it would be 32,000 euros, 42,000 euros, or 52,000 euros for that umbrella? Very useful.
The question that comes to mind is, why would you have such an umbrella? You know, you live in England as well. You know, this thing is just going to deteriorate after 2 days, you know, and being under the rain in any case.
I don't fully understand why it's quite so expensive either. Surely you just skin a crocodile and whack it on.
Yeah, you'd have to find an umbrella-shaped crocodile.
Yeah. Is that the cost breeding, the cost of breeding umbrella-shaped crocodiles?
Yeah, with yellow, red, green and white skin.
Such a dad joke, Ollie. You can really tell you've got a kid now.
Oh, no. It's not great, is it?
I would hope it's no more than 32,000, though. That would be ridiculous for the umbrella.
For both, it was 42,000 euros.
Oh, wow. So I'm really rubbish at that game, I've got to say. You know?
Right, shall I ask some true or false questions?
Go on in.
Let's do it. Okay, so true or false? In 2014, a number of electronic road signs were hacked in San Francisco. The messages were reprogrammed to read "Godzilla attack, turn back." Is that true or false?
That would be fun if it was true, wasn't it? Although maybe not for the people on the car in the cars, but yeah. 2014. Let's just say it's false.
True.
Oh no! Gosh, that's quite cool to do. Very dangerous, but quite cool to do.
I feel like even when they're not hacked, I've seen road signs that have sort of like semi-funny messages on them. I think whoever's in control of them is like having a good time.
Do you remember we dealt with that breach where the threat actor was actually like a 17-year-old who boasted online about all the things he was doing, and he'd hacked this particular company. I won't go into it, but he was, we found his Facebook page, and he'd posted pictures of how he'd hacked the screens at, I think it was Paddington or St Pancras Station. I can't remember which one. But he'd hacked all the departure screens and put a message on. And he was posting about it on Facebook. He was quite a notorious teenage hacking wizard, which is quite an interesting claim to deal with. Usually we're dealing with state actors and, you know, very, very professional criminal gangs of cyber criminals. But on this occasion, it was a 17-year-old in a hoodie in his bedroom hacking stuff. So,
he was just doing it for fun as well, wasn't he? So he was quite hard to encourage to stop because he just didn't really care and he was a teenager. Okay, so true or false, the malware that successfully hacked NASA in 2018 was called Moon Cheese.
I don't remember that one.
Are you going with false?
Well, I might as well get everything wrong. So I'm going to say that's true.
Oh, it's false.
I see what I mean.
You were right the first time. it's like a double bluff, isn't it? You can't win.
No.
Okay, we'll do one more. When a worm got into the control system of several nuclear research facilities in Iran, it activated workstations to play Thunderstruck by AC/DC at random times in the night. It was in 2012.
That is so detailed. I'm going to say that is true.
It is true.
Yeah.
One right.
Finish on a high.
Well, thank you very much for listening, and thanks to Letitia for being such a brilliant guest. If you like what you hear, please do spread the word by sharing our pod on social media. For any other information about our global cyber breach response team at Kennedy's, just search Kennedy's Cyber and you'll find all the information you need, as well as ways to contact us too. Until next time, take care and stay safe.